Controversy over the Supreme Court has engaged the attention of men and women in every walk of life. There is no racial or group distinction, and political or party lines are entirely erased. The greatest writers, the more eloquent speakers, and leaders of enterprise, business and professional throughout the nation are making their voices heard. It's a tremendously interesting forum, and people everywhere are being aroused to the vital significance of the issue at stake. The president has spoken. Political leaders on both sides have been heard. The clergy has been well represented, and outstanding educators of the country have testified. Today, you're to hear from another and vastly important class. You are asked to listen to Charles Coburn, an actor, producer, and manager known far and wide as a prominent and well-loved figure in the American theater. Mr. Coburn.
As a member of the Committee to Uphold Constitutional Government, and as a member of that vast fraternity that you know as the world of the stage, I can think of no better way in which to voice my conviction that the president's plan with regard to the Supreme Court is unwise than to quote the carefully studied opinions of two able and distinguished writers, both of them dramatists, both Americans. One of these men is Booth Tarkington, famous Hoosier dramatist. Just a few weeks ago, at his home in Indianapolis, he penned this monograph and dedicated it to the Society for the Preservation of American Ideals and Form of Government.
Just a word, Mr. Coburn. I think it would be interesting for listeners to know that some years ago you played in one of Booth Tarkington's plays. Wasn't it The Plutocrat?
That's right. It was a dramatization by Arthur Goodridge of Mr. Tarkington's novel. The title of his monograph that I am to read now is On Discarding the Dictionary. And these are Mr. Tarkington's words. My father, at the age of 91, told me he didn't feel old enough to glory in it. It is only to the young that the old seem old. When we are 10, 30 seems pretty old. And when we are 20, we look upon people who get married after the age of 40 as ludicrous and even rather scandalous. To the president's young middle age, and equipment of splendid vitality, which we hope will be the same 40 years from now, the age of 70 seems superannuated. To the painter Titian, working hard at 99 and then cut off untimely by the bubonic plague, 70 didn't seem old at all. To Titian, 70 seemed the age at which he'd just begun really to know how to handle the tools of his trade. Most of the disastrous mistakes recorded in history were made by men in middle age, younger middle age, and youth. I pause to mention merely as an infinitesimal item of the prodigious list, Napoleon at Waterloo, Wilkes Booth, and Pontius Pilate. In the view of anybody who doesn't prefer dust in his eyes, there are very few living men who wouldn't need to be at least 70 to be qualified to sit on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States. However, after listening attentively to orations by advocates of the bill, and after reading reports of the many statements and arguments in favor of it, I find that what remains in my mind as the boiled down grist of what I have heard and read may be expressed more simply as follows. These judges are too old because we've got to get them out of the way in order to change the Constitution without changing it. That is to say, the proponents of the bill do not only admit, they urge and proclaim that the present judges must be removed or overwhelmed because they stand in the way of certain policies. We may understand the matter better if we pause to inquire here, how do the judges stand in the way of those policies? The first part of the answer to that question seems to rest upon the fact that we, the people, are not infallible. Political orators often tell us we are, but we know better. We often reverse our most passionate opinions. We threw out the Democratic Party after Mr. Wilson. We threw out the Republican Party after Mr. Hoover. We threw in prohibition with great enthusiasm. We threw it out uproariously. Even our presidents are not infallible. And we prove how thoroughly we believe this by the way we reverse ourselves and turn on them, bringing to mind an old aphorism, republics are ungrateful. The framers of the Constitution understood our fallibility. They knew that they themselves, being human, needed to be protected from their own impulses. They knew that we, and our presidents also, would need this same protection. That is why we have a Constitution and its careful provision for amendments. The founders of the country knew that neither one man nor men in the mass are to be trusted to think rightly or for the general best interest in a hurry. Moreover, as the Constitution is the charter of our liberty, and therefore it is vital to us all that the words of the document should never be misunderstood or misapplied, its framers provided us with a dictionary. In regard to the Constitution of the United States, that's what the Supreme Court is. In essence and reality, it is a dictionary. The judges do not govern the people. And as for the policies in the way of which the present judges are alleged to stand as obstacles, the judges do not condemn those policies, nor praise them, nor in any manner criticize them. Some of the judges, and possibly, so far as we know, all of them may approve of those policies. It is not their business to tell us whether they do or not. Their business is solely with the words and groups of words used in the Constitution of the United States and its amendments. They are simply the highest authority we have on the meaning of those words and groups of words. All the judges can tell us is what those words mean, and by the Constitution itself, their majority opinion, no matter how large or how small a majority, settles the meaning of the word or groups of words in the Constitution. The judges do not say to all of us or to any of us, you shall do this thing or that thing, or you shall not do this thing or that thing. They only say, the word black means black, the word white means white. Proponents of the bill declare that its real purpose is to replace the present judges with men who will give the present president's good purposes so much at heart that in order to forward them, they will say to us, the people, the word black means white. The word white means black. That is to say, we shall henceforth have no dictionary. The words in our Constitution will henceforth mean whatever any president, good president or bad president, strong president or weak president, intelligent president or stupid president, and we have had all of these and shall again. The words of which our Constitution is composed will henceforth mean what any president wants them to mean. President Roosevelt knows his own good intentions and benevolent purposes. But we, the people, or at least many of us, are permitted to doubt if he himself would care to take the risk if he were one of us, a private citizen, and if Mr. Henry Ford, for instance, were president. We are pretty confident, in fact, that if this were the case, Mr. Roosevelt would prefer to keep the dictionary.
And now Mr. Coburn will read a brief statement by George Ade. Mr. Coburn appeared as Jim Heckler in George Ade's The County Chairman when it was given by the Players Club Revival last June.
Writing for the Society for the Preservation of American Ideals and Form of Government, George Ade said, all of us know that many of our friends and neighbors who voted for Mr. Roosevelt in November are amazed and somewhat appalled to find that he is interpreting the result of the election as an authorization to dismember and wreck the Supreme Court. I am merely a layman with no claim to expert knowledge regarding the merits of the cause he is pleading. But I know I am right in my conclusion that he hopes to subordinate both the legislative and the judicial branch of the government to his own will. In my opinion, he is adopting a policy which is unprecedented, dangerous, and possibly destructive of our liberties. He is hatching huge plans for reconstructing the whole social order, abolishing poverty, and delivering prosperity to the ill-housed, the scantily fed, and all those who suffer the penalties of the underprivileged. Even those who are compelled to wonder if he can change human nature and confer lasting benefits to the laggards, the sluggards, the incompetent, and the unwilling, are ready to admire the noble intent of his desire. But we are not ready to approve his plan to compel the Supreme Court to take orders from the White House. In his headlong and burning desire to get immediate results and put into effect all of his new policies, he is proposing that the United States shall break up housekeeping, get rid of all the old chattels, and rebuild the institution from the ground up. It is too sudden, too breathtaking, and too risky. He says that he does not propose to load up the Supreme Court with mere puppets. But everyone who knows that he would appoint to the court only those judges who would strain every point and hurdle every barrier to find their reasons for approving any and all measures which might be passed by the Congress under his direction. Anyone who does not know that much had better be treated for the simple. We are headed for a virtual dictatorship, and such a finish was never contemplated by the founders of our government. We are asked too hastily to approve a plan which should be studied for a long time and submitted to popular vote before being adopted. We are confronted by a crisis, and while we are dealing with it, we should not forget our history, our traditions, our safeguards, and above all else, the dangers which may await us in the future if we steer the ship of state into a new and uncharted sea.
Thank you, Mr. Coburn. You have just listened to Charles Coburn, one of the more distinguished figures of the American theater. He read from papers prepared by Booth Tarkington and George Ade, emphasizing the need of nationwide protest against the plan to pack the Supreme Court. Write to your senators and congressmen today, urging opposition to the president's proposal. Send to this committee, the National Committee to Uphold Constitutional Government, for copies of this address or for petitions and literature bearing on this issue. Address the committee or its chairman, Frank E. Gennett, at 205 East 42nd Street, New York City.